Hello, I'm Ross Cambridge, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the challenges, triumphs, ups and downs of all those who deal with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And continuing an idea that's been of interest to me about how aspects of cancer are communicated, I am delighted to have with me my next guest, Dr. Kadrin Wilfong. Kadrin, would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
First of all, thank you, Dr. Cambridge, for inviting me to your podcast. I'm thrilled to be here and to interact with you in a different capacity. To introduce myself, I'm a medical educator trained as a medical doctor, and I would also say a lifelong learner myself with a very curious mind. I have worked at Peerview, which is an organization focused on education and professional development of healthcare providers for nearly 21 years. Currently as a vice president of medical education, but functionally for most of my time and career at Peerview, I have served as a medical director responsible for grant development, educational program development and delivery, and analysis of impact and outcomes. My concentration is in solid tumor oncology, especially lung and breast cancer.
Tell me about the accent. Where are you from?
I am from Estonia, which is a small country in Northern Europe. Many people don't know where it is. So I always feel compelled to explain that it's one of the three small Baltic countries in Northern Europe, not Eastern Europe, across the Baltic Sea from Finland. So that kind of helps to position it. I grew up in Soviet Union, the USSR, but I had a very, very happy childhood. And I don't feel like that was very much impacted by where I was born and grew up.
I seem to remember Estonia was one of the early states that departed from the Soviet Union.
It was, yes. In 1992, it gained its independence finally after many years of being under Soviet rule and historically being overruled by many different countries. So we kind of value our independence very much. And being a member of such a small nation, that kind of nationalism is always in you. That's why I always bring it up.
I view the map in the simplistic way that you're somewhat to the left of Denmark and what are you, kind of north of France or something like that?
Yes, so somewhere in that part of the world.
Yeah, roughly there for the simplistic geography people of this world. So you grew up in Estonia, and then how many brothers and sisters did you have? I think you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest of four. I have two sisters, kind of two years younger than me, and then much younger brother.
And then I think you told me this about what your parents did for a living, and it was a very science forward family.
Yes, that's true. I grew up in a family with both of my parents being scientists, so that was our world. I mean, we spent endless hours at the lab waiting for our parents. All of the friends were scientists, so anytime we had a dinner or guests over, they were most likely scientists, and we were immersed in the conversations about science and medicine indirectly. So yes, that was our world, and that was the influence that we got since being kids, that, you know, this is pretty much the path we should follow. You have to be in the world of science if you want to be of anybody of meaning and importance. So
what kind of science?
They both studied chemistry at university, but then transitioned eventually as their career progressed into molecular biology and virology. They both focused on papillomaviruses, papillomavirus replication. So that's what they studied. And it's funny because my father's 75th birthday is coming up next week. So we've been having these conversations with my siblings and with my parents and kind of reflecting on our childhood. And it's one of the things that comes up that my parents always have gotten along very well, and they had a great relationship. The only time they argued was about the papillomavirus replications because they had a different understanding. My mother is very artistic and visual, so she had her ideas, and my father is very rational and very direct. So anytime they fought was about papillomavirus replication ever. So if I can remember, all of us can remember.
That sounds like a pretty fun upbringing. I mean, were you okay with the idea that, you know, you're all going to go into science? Did that fit with your mindset?
To a certain degree, yes. Another big influence was my grandmother, who was actually a music teacher and choir conductor. So that was a lot of influence from her. We all went to music school. We had to learn instruments. But she was also kind of a natural healer. She always was the one who was taking care of our wounds and, you know, when we fell down and got hurt and got sick. So she always thought that if she wasn't a music teacher, she would be a doctor. And then when I was in middle school, that interest was getting stronger. So I was working at the hospital, at the pediatric department, kind of like an aide, and asked one of my relatives to go, who was a surgical oncologist, to go see an operation of somebody with stomach cancer. So it was always there, but we were also very rebellious, or I was very rebellious. So we always fought against it. And yeah, when I went to university first, and I wanted to study linguistics and went to study English, but that lasted for 1 year. And after that, I switched over to medicine because I realized there was no point in going against the grain. So
I think you told me your parents thought medicine was the second grade career compared to science, though.
Yeah. So that was my way of continuing the rebellion of not going into biology or genetics or anything like that, by going to medicine, because they thought, you know, being a doctor is comparable to being like a car mechanic, because you're pretty much implementing what they study and discover at the labs, and we're not really finding anything. We're just kind of carrying out the effects and implementing it. But that was just then. That was, you know, obviously with humor. Ultimately, they were happy that we chose that career path, and until this day, they are. All of us did. Both of my sisters also went to medicine. My brother was the only obedient one who went to biology and into science directly. So,
I get this. There's this family of kind of like three eventual doctors, one scientist, two parents who are both scientists. And then how did you get to America?
Yeah, so my father, I don't even know until this day how that happened. But I think in 83, he had an opportunity to go to Sweden, Uppsala University, to do research. Then we weren't allowed to go with him because it was still the deep times in the Soviet Union. So they were afraid if you go with your family, you'll never come back. So it was only my father who went to Sweden.
So the rest of you were hostages?
Yeah, pretty much. We stayed in Estonia. My mother was allowed to visit once, like for a couple of weeks, but we still had to stay behind with our grandmother. And then he came back to Estonia, worked here for a couple of years. Then already the Soviet Union started crumbling, like the first signs of rebellion and things falling apart. And I think it opened up. So my father got an opportunity to come to the United States as a visiting scientist at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. He continued his research into papillomavirus replication, and my mother did as well when they came here. And then we were allowed to come with my parents. And yeah, we all came to U.S. and had a big shock of moving from Soviet Union to U.S. as a completely different society, not really speaking English, having to go to school, in my case, high school. I was around 15. And it was very eye-opening, but challenging at the same time.
It sounds utterly terrifying, I've got to say. But you're good with languages by the sound of it. So did you pick up English relatively quickly?
Yeah, within a couple of months, I would say. By, you know, we went to school in September as normal. And I think by Christmas time, we were able to converse and participate in school activities most of the time. I had hard times with a social integration because I was oldest, and high school can be hard for anybody. My younger siblings had an easier time.
How long did they work in the USA for?
We came in 1989 and went back in 92. I was sent first with my grandmother. And that was when the Estonian independence happened. And they had a choice of whether continuing their career at the US or then returning back home. And they opted to go back home to help build up the country and contribute to the new
free. The nationalism coming out, yeah. It's our country again, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
This incredible environment you're in, you're going through high school, but You were working in Cold Spring Harbor in your spare time?
I got a job there at Genes and Development, which was a journal being published at the labs. They had a publishing department, so I got a job there during my last year of high school as an editorial assistant. And so I worked with the editors to process the manuscript pretty much and ship them back to the writers and the authors. And then that led to boy trouble, which my parents weren't very happy about. And that was one of the reasons that I was sent back to Estonia before they did with my grandmother.
I love that. So there's the ultimate failure of parenting is to assume that you can actually control these things. But anyway, they tried, and you know, they sent you back to Estonia to keep you away from the boy.
Yeah, I should have, in retrospect, I should have listened to my parents, but I mean,
that's the way world goes, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they thought no boy or man would follow a young girl like that to the other side of the world, especially in the former Soviet Union and, you know, country that's in a very poor state in the beginning, despite being independent. But they were wrong. And
he did follow you back?
He did, yes. And then I, in return, followed him back to the U.S.
You know, whatever happened in the future, that displays a certain level of dedication.
Yeah, I am a very loyal person in many ways. So I think that reflects in my career and also my personal life, that I tried for a long time. But I mean, you don't make the best decisions when you're 18, 19 years old, and you change over time. So you kind of go with the flow. And
when did you get to medical school then? And in which country did you go to medical school?
I was planning to go to university. As I mentioned, I got the job at the last year of high school. So I was planning to go to university in the U.S. I had been accepted to several universities, was considering George Washington, Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, I think. But then when my parents decided that they needed to get me away from the U.S., I went back to Estonia and I applied for the university there. As I mentioned, the first year at the English department, I wanted to study English. And it was natural because I already, you know, had been in the English environment and was proficient by that time. And then a year later, I decided that it wasn't for me and I wanted to go into medicine. And I applied to the medical school in Estonia, University of Tartu, which is the main oldest university in Estonia. And I got accepted. My sister, who's 2 years younger than me, she graduated by that time from high school and decided to follow in my footsteps. So both of us applied the same year and got accepted to the medical school. And we attended for the 6-year curriculum together.
So your sister was in the same year as you at medical school?
Yeah, because I had that year between when I went to study English. So she kind of caught up with me and we attended medical school together for all of the 6 years and graduated together too. So
you graduated medical school when?
In 1999.
Okay. And as you're going through medical school, do you have an idea as to what kind of doctor you want to be or how you want to use that degree?
Well, oncology was always an interest. I mentioned then even when I was in middle school, I was kind of wanting to learn more about it. Later on, my grandmother, who I mentioned, she had multiple cancers. So that kind of also increased the interest and kind of dedication to do something in that area. So oncology was always something that wasn't at the back of my mind and that I wanted to get involved in. And that was the plan. I came back to the U.S. in 1999 after graduation as soon as I could. I left and came back to New York. And then my full intent was to take the necessary exam and start the internship and residency and fellowship and follow the normal course of becoming a doctor in the U.S. But by then I had a little kid. My son was born and he was born during medical school. So I was doing that in parallel. And he was 5 years old when I graduated and came to the U.S. So it just was very hard for me to imagine leaving him and knowing how demanding internship and residency can be, the training you have to essentially live at the hospital and at the clinics for long days. And we had no family support there. There was no family, no grandparents or anybody to help out. So my idea was that until he gets a little bit older, I'll get a job in another field of interest, unrelated field of interest, and do that until I'm ready to then continue that path of becoming a doctor. So having had that history in publishing, when I worked at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, I got a job in New York City with a publisher. But the focus of that publisher was psychiatry and psychology. So that still kind of didn't align.
They were a publisher of journals or textbooks? What kind of publisher?
Journal publication. But they also had, all those journals had CME components. So that was my first introduction to CME, the journal-based CME, where there were questions tied to the articles published in a journal and offering CME credit to that audience. So that's how I first learned about CME, was while working at that publishing house.
That's a great segue so that we can try and explain to anyone who's non-medical listening to this what CME stands for and what it really is.
CME stands for Continuing Medical Education. The intent is to translate all the fast-paced scientific and medical advances to real-world practice, provide education to the healthcare provider community. So we all know how quickly things change. And if you consider that a typical medical doctor practices for 30 or 40 years, so what they study at the medical school and during their training over those 30 to 40 years becomes outdated very quickly in the context of the fast-paced scientific developments and medical developments. So we all recognize that it's very hard for individual physicians and healthcare providers to keep up with the science and the advances, the new approvals, the new indications, the new drug classes, so forth. So CME is in that role to help translate that information to real-world practice.
Do you know if CME is just something which is offered and, you know, physicians can take it or leave it, or are there mandates that they have to do CME? And I've seen this in something, you have to accrue certain numbers of CME credits, but I still don't know if that's a kind of national thing or just like an institutional thing.
It is mandated by many states. I mean, it varies by the regulatory body overseeing different healthcare providers and states, but it is a mandate for many healthcare providers to pursue continuing medical education throughout their career. And in many cases, it's tied to licensing requirements. It's different in other countries, but in US, it's a requirement for many healthcare providers to continue their education throughout their career and obtain a certain number of CME credits over a certain period of time to maintain in licensure.
So you're working for this journal, a psychiatry journal. They've got some CME aspects going on in there. Are you fulfilled by that? You said psychiatry is not your love.
No, it was not. I mean, it was interesting. It was totally different, and I enjoyed it to a certain extent. But when the opportunity came, and one of my former colleagues from that publishing house referred me to a person who was involved with peer review from the early stages, I jumped on that opportunity and interviewed and got the job. So it wasn't when I switched over to peer review, I didn't focus only on oncology exclusively in the beginning. We were such a small organization at first that I did pretty much everything, all the therapeutic areas. So I have done covered a lot of different topics, but swiftly over a relatively short period of time, I focused on oncology and started developing oncology focused education at PeerView. So
how big was PeerView when you interviewed with them?
We were very small then. I mean, I'm not going to get into numbers, but we had a small group of people. Many of them are still with PeerView. I'm one of them. So we have a few people who have been there from the beginning. But yes, we have grown a lot over the years. And
the way I encountered CME, I guess in different ways, but one way is when you go to conferences and you're seeing these satellite symposia that sort of go on at lunchtime or in the evening on some educational topic. And there's a relatively small number, at least in the field I work in, of players in that field. I would probably say only about four or five. But peer review is definitely one of them. And also you are peer review as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you are the dominant player. So I think you said you're now vice president?
Yes, I'm vice president of medical education.
Is that, again, across all disease areas or just in oncology?
Just in oncology. That's my concentration is solid tumor oncology. And we have other people responsible for other solid tumors and then liquid tumors and also non-oncology topics. We have general medicine team that covers everything else outside of oncology.
I mean, CME sounds like it can be some questions in a journal. As I said, it can be some presentations at a conference, but there's also a whole bunch of online stuff. So what did you start off in?
So yes, CME is being delivered and offered by many different organizations, academic centers, hospitals, societies offer CME. But then there are also continuing medical education organizations who are accredited CME providers, such as PeerView, who are entirely focused on this area of providing continuing professional development and education with the goal of improving knowledge and skills of healthcare providers. So yes, this is our sole focus. And we ourselves feel that we are the best in the oncology field.
I should hope so. You should always feel that you're the best. And to some extent, I think that's justified. I mean, I think during the times I've interacted with you, what always struck me was the amount of work you put in to preparing it. Maybe because of that science background and that medicine background, but you would also create, you know, handouts that were just so incredibly detailed and educational with infographics. It was just like a level above what some of the other companies were doing. So, you know, one can't have favorites, but I would say that, you know, you and PeerView have been one of my favorites. There we go. That's very diplomatic.
No, thank you. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I do think that we have a very talented team of tenured professionals who are very dedicated to what we do. And we always go above and beyond. And I think we're also very adaptable and adjustable. I mean, I think things have changed over time. Obviously, we encountered COVID a couple of years ago, and I think we have been successfully able to, you know, be agile and be able to navigate the ebb and flow of things and continue our growth and success. And I think it all comes down to the people we have in our team and the effort we put into our programs. CME is not only one thing, as you said. So there are different ways to construct and deliver CME. There are live events, there are online educational events in different formats. And we do it all, and I think we do it very well. So
let me try and ask some dumb questions about CME. Well, first of all, I mean, there's a gazillion topics. How do you choose, like, you know, this conference, this virtual thing? And this doesn't have to be specific to peer review, sort of, you know, your general insights into the industry. You know, how do you choose what topic is, you know, going to be presented? I mean, there's only so many lunchtime slots.
Our opportunities and needs for education correlate with the scientific and medical advances. So, I mean, our goal is to translate, to convey the latest advances. So that's where we focus our efforts, and our proposals are aligned with the latest developments, because there is a need to translate and convey that information to the community of healthcare providers. We do rigorous needs assessments to identify what those needs are, and that, you know, is based on many different sources. We review literature, we attend conferences, and then pay attention to the trends. We speak with experts such as yourself. And then also, as we develop our education, as I mentioned before, I think one of the goals is to measure the impact and identify further needs. So all of our educational programs also look for gaps and needs, and all of that is considered into what we propose for the potential programs to be developed.
You said right at the beginning that one of your roles is, you know, writing grants, and so it's, again, on a simplistic level, presumably there is no CME company that has its own funds. They're essentially creating a product that they want someone to fund, and then they create the product and put it out there. So who funds CMAs? Is it institutions or is it mostly pharma?
So there are many different sources, but again, I think the issue is that the fast pace of scientific and medical development, medical advances, it's hard to keep up with them. So there's a need for this education that exceeds the capacity of federally funded education or medical schools and academic centers or hospitals to do that on their own. Commercially funded CME is standard, but we have to follow rules and regulations that have been set forth for the CME industry very strictly. So the goal of those rules and regulations is to ensure independence of the education that we provide. So even if it is funded by commercial sources, they have no influence on the content. And we have to follow steps to become an accredited CME provider ourselves. And each activity follows certain rules and regulations set forth by the regulatory bodies to ensure the independence and balance and high quality of the education.
Yeah, I mean, even if I give a talk in an institution or anywhere, I usually have to sign a form that says I'll give appropriate spread of influence across, you know, the whole range, that I won't use trade names, that I'll use kind of generic names if at all possible. And, you know, again, to try and give unbiased information, which is, of course, you know, what we'd like in all news sources, but at least CME seems to have got its act together to sort of regulate it. That said, does ASCO put out a thing saying, you know, hey, we're seeking applications for this evening's seminar? Or is it, you know, choose your favorite drug company who puts out the thing saying, you know, we're interested in applications for an evening seminar? I mean, again, it doesn't have to be specific to peer review. How do those, you know, pieces fit together? Because I'm just the recipient. I just turn up and either give a talk or I turn up and I have my free dinner and I enjoy the talk.
Yes, I mean, there are different paths to it. There are requests for proposal processes that are put out by the commercial supporters that anybody, any of the accredited providers can apply for those funds. We still have to follow the standards for integrity and independence of the accredited continuing education, regardless of what the source is. Often the ideas are generated by us ourselves based on the needs assessment that we have conducted. As I mentioned before, there's a process that we follow all the time and we collect data from different sources about healthcare and practice gaps and unmet needs. And then we develop grant proposals to obtain funding based on what we have discovered as a result of this needs assessment process.
I'm trying to think when the academics, the speakers get approached in the process. I've certainly sort of had the email saying, hey, we want to do a symposium at X. And just occasionally they'll come back and say, well, we didn't get it. But most of the time they do. But again, is it like, you know, making a movie and you say, well, we've got Tom Cruise lined up, and even if you haven't, but it gets the other people lined up. When you're making your pitch to the sponsor, have you already approached your speakers, or you're saying, here will be a speaker such as Tom Cruise? I'm not Tom Cruise, by the way.
No, I mean, that. I think the speaker selection really is also done independently. We always do that at the stage of when we have the funding to proceed with the education. I don't think the idea of you pitching using the expert plays any role. So the faculty selection is always done following the rules of the ACCME and our own CME rules and regulations.
How do they work? This is the side I don't know anything about. So what rules are going on when they decide to approach me or not approach me?
Well, everything that we do has to follow the standards of integrity and independent accredited continuing education. Those are the rules that have been in place since 2020. And the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, or the ACCME, is kind of the overseeing steward of the standards for integrity. And many of the other accrediting bodies have signed up and are under the same agreement to follow those rules and regulations. So PeerView has achieved joint accreditation recommendation, which means joint accreditation for interprofessional continuing education offers organizations an opportunity to simultaneously accredit for different professions through a single kind of process and accreditation standards. And to get the commendation status, you have to meet a number of criteria that go beyond the basics, and that gives you accreditation for a longer period of time. So there are disclosure forms that all of the faculty that we work with have to sign and have to follow before we can work with them. So there, you mentioned that you always have to fill out a form. So you can't be affiliated with a pharmaceutical company in certain capacities. Yeah. So yes, there are disclosure forms that all the faculty are required to fill out, and we have our own team of people who resolve any conflicts or assess any potential conflicts and resolve them. And if they don't meet those criteria, then those faculty are not allowed to participate in the program, which does happen. So we definitely follow the process closely in that regard.
One of the things that I remember talking to you about, which was really fascinating, is who prepares the slides for presentations? Because, you know, you're sitting in the audience and you're assuming the person standing up there giving this presentation has prepared their presentation. And certainly that's the, you know, I get given a title, and sometimes I'll even suggest changes to the title because, you know, I'm a pain in the butt, and I'll sort of say, well, no, we should change this, that, and the other. And I always write my own slides, but apparently that's not uniform.
Well, I think there are different ways to do that. We always develop the content under the expertise of the faculty who are the main experts who work with, and we have been selected carefully based on their publication history and their area of expertise and what they have focused on. So if it is not developed, the slides are not developed by the faculty directly, then they're done jointly between us and the faculty. But we never prepare slides and expect faculty to kind of speak to slides that have not been vetted by them, developed collaboratively with them, and all the content has to obviously follow CMA review process also. So there's an external reviewer that has to review and sign up on all the educational content that's put out there.
That brings up a really interesting distinction between CME and something which we may have to explain to the audience, speakers bureaus. And a speakers bureau to me is, I have occasionally been asked to do this and I've always turned it down, but my understanding is where they are literally giving you a canned slide deck and you cannot deviate from it. And it is very much, you know, brand name and marketing messaging. And my argument is, look, this is Ken. You don't need my expertise. You can literally get Tom Cruise to do it. You just need an actor to do it, although probably lower paid. Is that a fair assessment? The speakers bureaus, are they completely separate from CME?
Absolutely. We have nothing to do with speakers bureaus, and we are accredited providers. All of our programs are CME accredited, so we have to follow those rules that ensure independence and quality of the content, and there is no influence from the pharmaceutical side on the content from that sense. So they don't review, they don't control, they don't see any of this. Accredited CME and speaker bureaus and commercially directed educational programming, they're completely different worlds. They have to follow different rules and regulations. So we do not have involvement in any of that.
I think you told me just the scale of your operation at ASCO. I mean, it was like, so ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, multiple different tumor types, multiple different tracks. And of course, I live in my little lung cancer track and, you know, my ivory tower, and I don't know what else is going on. But it was some mind-blowing number of different presentations over about 4 days. What was it, like nearly 20 or something?
Yes. So in ASCO 2024, we had 18 different programs focused on different solid and liquid tumors. So yes, 18 satellite symposia at ASCO just by peer review.
Do you have to be at all of them as the vice president, or can you just like delegate and go, okay, guys, you're going to do great?
Well, I have my own programs. We have a full team. Everybody handles a certain number of them. But yes, I definitely was part of ASCO and actively involved in developing the programs focused on breast and lung cancer, which is my kind of subspecialty.
One of my favorite stories that I want to share is you mentioned COVID, and that first ASCO after COVID, which I think was 2022, and it was so funny coming back, and like people had forgotten how to pack suitcases, and I remember people were excited about being in a hotel. Look, they have tiny bottles of shampoo. This is awesome. And I saw you early on, and I gave you the biggest hug. Like, I, you know, like you were my best friend and I hadn't seen you. It was just seeing people again. It was just, so that hug has stayed in my memory as the end of COVID in many, and you gave me a nice hug back. So I appreciate that. It must have been so, so difficult in CME, like you said, to sort of, you know, have this, like, we're moving in one direction and then, hey, we're going to shut down all of the conferences. It was like, wow, how do you even pivot on that? I mean, it must have been, it's because it's kind of like it's life or death for the company.
Yes. And as I mentioned, we are very agile and adjustable. So yeah, we pivoted, everything went virtual. The satellite symposia never went away. Everything just went online, and we deliver programs for ASCO, for all other conferences virtually over the couple of years. And it was a great learning experience also. You have to get up to speed on the technology and capabilities very quickly. And many of those things we have continued even to the post-COVID environment. So it was hard, obviously, for everybody, but I think we adjusted and adapted, and we even grew from that. So I think all in all, it was a beneficial experience for everybody. But I won't lie that it was very wonderful to be back in person. And I remember that hug from you and seeing all the other faculty that we work with. So I think it was everybody's happy to be back and attending the conferences and doing the live educational symposia in person. Again, it's a completely different experience. And yeah, to work with people. I mean, with you, we worked for the first time in 2016, and I remember that very clearly. That was a program where we involved one of your patients, Janet Freeman Daly, as a speaker. And that's something that we do consistently also, is the kind of the patient engagement and including the patient perspective in our programs. So I remember that program where you and Janet were involved. We had Nairis, Vian, Cao. So that was our first experience with you. And from there on, you became one of our favorite faculty because you were so impressive. You mentioned how you like to develop your own talks, and your talk was so engaging, amusing, educationally focused. I mean, kind of the teaching aspect of it was so impressive that we wanted to continue working with you. And I think you are one of our all-time favorite faculty. And we invited you back the next year, in 2017, and have continued to work with you. Well, not funny, but interesting aspect is that you made, during those couple of years, you made introductions to us, to new and emerging faculty who are now our go-to people. So you suggested Alex Drillon as an upcoming expert in lung cancer, and we included him in one of the programs early on. And look where Alex Drillon is now. The same thing with Stephen Liu. You sent me an email suggesting that if you want to develop a relationship with somebody new in the thoracic oncology space, and you would suggest Stephen Liu, and he's very smart and great.
He is.
We work with him all the time. So
it's funny.
The visionary of the future.
It's funny. That's the sort of thing that actually makes me very happy, to kind of, you know, spot that talent and then bring it on. Actually, I have to tell you a small funny story about that first meeting with Naya Rizvi, is Anso from MD Anderson was giving her talk. And Naya, who's very funny, had scribbled some funny cartoon on a slide of paper and slid it over to me. And I got the terrible giggles. And it's like, you know, all the cameras are on Anne and she's trying to be terribly professional. And I'm just like acting like a five-year-old with the giggles here. And I'm just, I've got to keep it together. But I still have that cartoon that Naya sent me, which is on the board behind me. So yes, I'm sorry to reveal to the audience that the speakers are just as grossly immature on stage as they sometimes are off the stage. But let's come back to you, and let's round this out. So your brilliant idea with your five-year-old son that, you know, you're just going to do this for a little while seems to have slid by the wayside, because your son is how old now?
He's 30.
Okay, so I'm guessing you're not going back to medical school at this point.
definitely not medical school, even though I have considered my youngest sister. She went into, after medical school, she went to research for a couple of years. And then after doing that for 4 or 5 years, she decided to go back and kind of go through the process of applying and taking the exams and internship and residency. And now she's a practicing oncologist in Estonia. So I have an example in her that kind of still pulls at me sometimes.
I think you said we can't do everything in life. And so, you know, sometimes there are kind of paths that we don't go down. But I think you've been very successful in the path you've done, and you've changed the world maybe in a different way from the way you envisioned. But, you know, over the next few years, is anything going to change? What do we want Dr. Will Fong to be doing in 5 years' time, personally and professionally?
Yeah, I have no regrets. I have loved being in the CME world. I have learned a lot. It kind of helps also to address my, I mentioned in the beginning that I have a strong streak of curiosity. I think that's one of my main characteristics, and kind of the desire to continuously learn myself is perfect for this environment, because as I, you know, do the research to be able to develop these programs, address the needs, stay up to date myself, I get to develop along with the audience that we, you know, aim to educate. So I think it's a preferred world for me. And even though the direct patient care is sometimes that I, you know, think that maybe I would have made a really good oncologist, and I would like to have had that impact directly on patients, I feel like the work that I do, I still am able to impact patients and patient care and outcomes through the work, through the education. And I mentioned before, kind of the patient engagement is another passion of mine. So for many years, I have been a proponent of that also, of integrating patient perspectives into the programs, patient education, those resources that you mentioned, the downloadable, we often include education for patients as part of those downloadable resources. We work with patient organizations, patient advocacy organizations all the time. Longevity in lung cancer space, for example, is our main partner. They were part of all of our ASCO programs. So I feel like even though I am not in a clinic and caring for the patients on a daily basis, I'm still able to impact the patients. And that's very satisfying and gratifying to me.
Yeah, I mean, just think about it. So there are physicians that could be doing the wrong thing if it wasn't for you. And so you're right, you might be one step removed from seeing the patient and touching the patient yourself, and yet your impact is huge.
Yes. So, I mean, that is part of the reason why I stayed with this path and have continued focused on education, because it is a different way to a similar end result, and potentially even more so based on how many people we reach with our educational program. So yes, I mean, we can make plans, and like they, as they say, you know, you plan and got laughs, but I hope that I can continue my journey in the medical education and professional development world, and with Peerview, hopefully. I mean, who knows? How I also have a strong need for improvement and change. So I hope that's possible in Peerview, and we can continue doing that together. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for innovation in CME and educating in different ways, whether using different educational design approaches or different format. And also looking outside of CME, I think we learn from different industries and different areas what works there, and it can spark new ideas. So that's why I try to have a broad scope and kind of look into different areas to get new ideas, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, but I think it makes it exciting and gives an opportunity for creativity and innovation in education. The pace of scientific advances is not slowing down, especially in oncology, so I think there's not going to be a lack of opportunity to continue to educate the audience and help them stay on top of things, because it is so hard. It is, I mean, if you think about the community oncologist who doesn't specialize in one area, I think it's so hard to envision how they are able to stay up to date across different tumor types, considering how fast things change. So we do what we can in our role to help them do that. But I know it's hard for everybody. But we have to do it for the patients.
Given how a lot of your career was shaped by putting the needs of your son at the center of it, I hope he appreciates that. I mean, he's in his 30s now. Does he know what his mom did for him and what's your relationship like with him?
I think so. I think he is very appreciative. I have a very close relationship with my son. He, after he turned 18, came back to Estonia from the U.S. and he lives in Estonia permanently now. He has his own family. And that's because he loves our big family. You know, I have a big family here. I have siblings, my parents, all of my siblings' kids, and we have a big, supportive, amazing family. So he wanted that and he came here for that reason. And I think he has inherited my rebellious streak because he hasn't necessarily followed the path that everybody expected for him, but he also has followed my father's footsteps in the sense of having an entrepreneurial spirit, because my father, when he came back to Estonia, eventually he went from academic science to business. He developed his own, he started his own biotech company, and my son works with him, but now also started his own company that's totally different, in a different world. So I think he appreciates the support and me being available for him and there for him all those years to guide him, but also find his own path just like I did, whether part of rebellion or as a result of circumstance. So
I love it. Full circle. Catherine, I can't thank you enough. This was wonderful. I wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Kamich. It was great to speak with you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamich. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at Dr. Kamich on X for additional commentary.